This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to an episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Dr. Daniel Yuta to tell us all about his book, just out from Yale University Press in 2023, titled Transparency, The Material History of an Idea, which is a really cool book. It investigates both the kind of concept of transparency, that we think that transparent things are inherently better and more open and more free. Where did we get that idea from? And the book also helps us understand literal transparency. Many of us are probably listening to this in, for example, buildings with big glass windows. When, how, and why did that come to be? And how are these two different things interlinked? So as you can probably tell, I found this book fascinating. And so Daniel, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to tell us about it.
Thank you, Miranda. Happy to be here.
Before we get into all things transparency, though, could you please introduce yourself a little bit to our audience and explain why you decided to write this book?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Miranda. My name is Daniel Yuta. I teach at New York University in the Department of History. I teach primarily history of early modern Europe between 1400 and 1800. But I have a larger thematic interest that transcends that particular period. It's an interest in the history of the built environment, the history of material culture, urban history, broadly speaking. And the book has really grown out over many years, grown out of this thematic interest. And I was trying, as you say, I was trying to write a book that brings together two areas that we don't often maybe think of being entangled, consider to being entangled, the history of material culture and intellectual history, the history of ideas, of a very powerful idea of our times, the idea of transparency, coupling that with the history of a particular material commodity that I think we all take for granted, maybe take for granted too easily, that is glass, architectural glass especially. So that's my background, and that's where the project emerged from. And it took a number of years, but now it's done.
And now we get to talk about it. So as you've mentioned in that answer, the book is not sort of two halves smushed together. It's not an intellectual history and then a material history or the other way around. It's woven throughout, which is fascinating because we don't usually put them together. And I'm going to try and mimic that with this interview. So going from the material culture to the intellectual history and seeing how they go together to mimic what you've done so well in the book. So starting with the kind of straightforward background, I suppose, right at the beginning, if we're talking about glass, you start us off mainly with the Romans. But the Romans don't seem to be using glass for architectural purposes. So take us to this beginning point. Why aren't they using it?
Yeah, thank you. It was one of the challenges in writing this book was to go back that far into antiquity. As I said, I usually study European history of a much later period. But I felt that in this case, with this book and this argument, it was necessary to go all the way into antiquity. You rightly say that the Romans were, first of all, not the first to use glass in as a society, and they used it reluctantly in their architecture. So there are two questions that arise here. Why did pre-Roman societies not produce glass windows in the first place, and why were the Romans, who mastered that eventually, why were they reluctant? Well, I think the first question is has to do with technical constraints, that glass blowing as a technique was not yet known in pre-Roman times. That is a big innovation that the Romans introduced, and that I think many people don't know that glass panes for centuries, window glass, was made of cylinders, was made of a glass blown cylinder that was then cut up longitudinally. So that is a technique that did not exist in pre-Roman times. There were ways of casting glass into panes, but that was apparently exceeding prohibitively expensive, and therefore also did not gain traction. And then climatic factors play a role as well. A glass making was first discovered, that the techniques around glass making were first discovered in the ancient Middle East in a climate where the glass is not necessarily a desirable choice for sealing your windows. There is other issues that are much more important, protecting the home from glare or from stifling heat. And there are technologies that do that better than architectural glass. There are lattices, there are other sort of timber or stone grills actually in later Islamic architecture would give us the so-called mashrabiya, the incredibly fine timber lattice work that is still forms part of traditional Islamic architecture. So that's the broader cultural context, in addition to the technological factors. And the Romans did master glass blowing, but they did not at first apply it to windows. That is something that really, in my opinion, only starts when the Roman Empire expands in Northern Europe, and when questions of thermal insulation, weatherproofing, protection from heat loss become a lot more important as a function of Roman imperial expansion beyond its Mediterranean home base.
So that, I think, is a very helpful starting point because it kind of pokes at some things we maybe don't, assumptions we have that we don't interrogate. For example, what do you mean glass is not the most ideal substance? And also kind of, well, what if you have this technology, why wouldn't you use it, right? And it's useful to kind of disrupt those expectations before we move forward. So I'm wondering if I can ask you to tell us a little bit more about why, having figured out this technology, you consider the role of glass windows to have an ambiguous position for the Romans. Tell us more about that reluctance you mentioned.
That was something that was fascinating for me to learn more about. Again, I knew next to nothing about this when I began this research. We have all, I think any of us who has ever stepped into a gallery of Roman art and culture will have seen countless shards of glass vessels, other glass objects, which would, would maybe suggest to us that glass was among the most prized objects in Roman society. But it was not. The Romans had a very pragmatic attitude towards glass in general. They used it for vessels, quotidian vessels, containers, jars, cups. But they also considered glass to be ultimately a cheap material, which had a lot to do with its the ingredients from which glass is made. Glass is made is of 80% so sand, which is which the Romans considered to be a base material compared to silver, gold, other metals. And for that reason, as one scholar has put it, Stuart Fleming, glass, I quote him, set low in the hierarchy of Roman material values. It was considered to be something that that had its purpose in certain pragmatic context, but in the most refined settings, Romans would have shunned it. We have reports of Roman emperors who would refuse to drink from glass cups and instead insisting on finer cups made of crystal or, again, silver or gold. And in architecture, we see the same phenomenon. As I said, the Romans did, for the first time in human history, on a large scale, use glass in architectural purposes, but only in certain genres of architecture where it was pragmatically wise to do that, in the bathhouses especially. So again, where the issue of heat loss and weatherproofing was of essential importance, especially with the expansion of the Roman Empire into Northern Europe, glass was used. It was rarely used in imperial architecture, in the kind of architecture that was meant to project power and prestige, and it was not at all used in sacred architecture, Roman sacred architecture, which it gives us the most fascinating contrast with what is coming later in Christianity, when glass does for the first time get associated with certain theological notions of light and purity, but in ways that in Roman society would have been more or less inconceivable, because again, glass was not seen to have that inherent prestige.
So, in fact, that is where I'd like to go next. Now that we've established what Rome did and did not value from glass, as you've mentioned, Christianity had a very different perspective, particularly if we go into medieval churches. Why did they want so much glass? And why was it specifically colored glass that was so valuable?
Yeah, thank you. I think that is really a fundamental, it's a watershed moment here in Western cultural history, in the history of architecture and art, that we observe a paradigm shift between Roman and post-Roman times. As I said, in Roman architecture, glass was not used in sacred architecture. We also have to keep in mind here that Roman religion, which was a very heterogeneous set of beliefs in the first place, but Roman religion was primarily an outdoors-based religion. The cults were transacted outside of the temple. What we now think of as the Roman temple, the Greek, and by extension the Roman temple, was actually largely reserved for certain liturgical practices by the priests and served often as kind of oversized vaults for precious religious instruments, also for looted artworks or other sort of booty that the Romans had amassed. The actual religious practices were often outdoors, animal sacrifices, and so on. And so we have there's a very different way in which religious life and religious service is conducted. Christianity moved religious service, worship, into the interior, and is from the beginning, Christianity was a more congregation-based form of religion compared to Roman religion. So the need to be indoors also comes with greater attention to the need for light, which is also, of course, you need certain light levels to perform congregational service, prayers, other forms of liturgy that are more text-based than Roman religion was. I think that's one factor that called for more attention to light, natural light, and lighting levels in the interior. The other factor, though, is a more symbolic, in that the early Christian communities and well into the early Middle Ages see themselves in a competition with Roman solar cults, especially the Roman idea of a sol invictus, of a sun god, is something that was seen as as requiring supersession by the idea of Christ as the light of the world, right? That's one of the famous lines in the New Testament in John, Christ saying, "I am the light of the world." Then countless church fathers elaborating on this idea, referring to him as light from light. There are different variations on that theme. But in any case, the way in which Christ was fashioned as a divine figure with emanating light, emanating divine light, called for a way in which that theology can be translated into a concrete experience. And the ever larger glass windows that emerge in the medieval cathedral and that very powerful dramaturgy or drama of polychrome light serve to reinforce that message about Christ as a luminous figure, also invoking certain associations with other parts of the New Testament, passages about the heavenly Jerusalem from Revelation, where the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of God, is described as having walls made of colored gemstones. That's certainly another thing that early Christians were aspiring to emulate, to mimic, and to imitate, and to emulate in their sacred architecture. But it's but the other factors that I've mentioned are just as important, and it gives us a wholly new aesthetic of sacred space compared to the Roman period.
Absolutely, and I think it gives anyone listening a very different thing to consider next time they happen to encounter one of these churches that still has all of this colored glass. I was fascinated to read that part of the book, but then equally kind of intrigued going further to read that despite the fact that the churches really had quite a lot of stained glass and it was so important to them, medieval people in their everyday homes were not really using glass still at this point. So how did they seal their windows, especially if we're moving north of Rome? And why wasn't glass still very high on the list?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is again a question of cost, I think, more than anything else. Glass was expensive. It's an expense that people felt was the right choice for the church being the house of God in this world. So there are, you could say, in modern terms, anachronistic terms, there are fundraising campaigns throughout the Middle Ages to have to produce these wonderful Gothic cathedrals with their comprehensive stained glass cycles. And often that's why donors are inserted into medieval stained glass windows, because someone had to pay for this and it was extremely expensive. But in an ordinary quotidian setting, people often looked for cheaper choices. And there were a number of choices, a range of alternatives to glass that existed that have virtually been forgotten. Here again, I tremendously enjoyed this research because it made me aware of a range of domestic technologies that we don't know about, and even the words have fallen into oblivion. They are in English, for instance, in medieval English, people spoke of fenestrals, a term that we don't no longer use, even though you might know that in Romance language, finestra or fenetra means window. But in medieval English, a fenestral referred to a type of window that was sealed with fabrics, linen, stretched linen, sometimes stretched parchment, other animal skins, even animal bladders, or mineralic objects, thinly sliced mineralic stones and so on, that could serve legitimately as window sealants and as alternatives to glass. They were, as I said, they were typically cheaper. They were also easier to install, easier to repair, and easier to maintain. Glass is a very delicate technology. As I said, the producing glass panes of a large size required particular techniques. And in the absence of glass casting, which was not available as a technology in the Middle Ages, even though in antiquity it had existed, most glass panes, most glass windows were multi-piece composites held together by lead panes. So if one piece broke out, you had to reassemble, to repair that particular piece, cut it back into the size. It's a delicate operation. Whereas if you just have a piece of linen that spans a wooden frame, that is something that you can some do-it-yourself techniques. You can repair that. We have as late as the 17th century. I'm speaking now from the perspective of someone who lives in America. The story of the Mayflower colonists who advised their friends in England, writing back to England to actually bring paper and oil for their windows. That's coming out of a letter of one of the Mayflower people, reminding us that in a society where people were also quite mobile and where do-it-yourself was sometimes a survival technique, glass was not necessarily a very pragmatic choice. And therefore, these other types of sealants lend themselves much better. They also lend themselves to personalization, I should add, in that people like to adorn their windows with particular, say, heraldic symbols, stories, sometimes entire stories or other visual scenes were added to windows. Of course, that isn't something that derives from the aesthetic of stained glass, but with textile windows, you can do that yourself. And we know that householders throughout the Middle Ages and the early modern period were actually quite keen to individualize their windows, which is another thing we've lost. I think there are very few elements of our built environment today that are more standardized than windows. And of course, we expect them to be fully transparent. That is not the expectation in this period. There are other expectations that people bring to their windows, and individualization and personalization, including through painting, is something that mattered a lot to people.
I have this great mental image of all the sort of late medieval, early modern villages that we see in films and kind of going, wait a second, what if they all had really colorful, painted, woven, etc. windows? That would be quite fun.
Yes, it would be fun. And I think we've completely lost even our visual understanding of what these things look like. I had to scramble for good images in the book. The textual records inventories may just mention that there was a fenestrel, or in Italian, these things were called impanata, a textile window. But there are very few images, paintings from this period that actually show us these things in the background. Because again, this wasn't something that was considered to be necessarily worthy of inclusion in painting, especially in a period when a lot of painting is religious painting. But here and there we have this evidence, and it was fascinating to get a glimpse into a world that it's very hard for us to visualize. Historical movies get that part wrong for the greater part because, as you say, we have no visual sense of what these things would have even looked like.
And that in and of itself, I think, speaks so strongly to just how much glass has essentially won, right? Because we do have archives of other things that go back further. So the fact that we have so little material of this speaks to a pretty significant transformation away from this world that you're bringing us back to get to where we are now. So let's move into kind of understanding how that happened. You note in the book that really one of the first places to start using glass in windows besides the church were in late medieval hospitals. Why was this the first sort of place that had clear glass windows?
Yeah, that was another surprise for me in this research, observing this pattern, because as you say, the question, it's the elephant in the room with this argument. So when does glass gain, when does it start to prevail? When does it start to predominate? In which particular time? For what particular reasons? And my answer to this is multi-pronged, but I see medieval hospitals as playing a pioneering role here in that transition from textile windows to glass in a secular context. And churches is a different story. Churches always had glass, but in secular architecture, it's the hospitals that play that transitional role. And I attribute that partly to the 14th century and the enormously consequential experience of the plague in the 1340s, which compelled people to think to rethink their priorities, their expectations as far as Windows were concerned. And it my reading of the material is that tight protection, you know, the tightness, the ability to insulate interiors from air, not necessarily cold air, but foul air, became a big concern. And glass was seen as doing this more effectively than other sealants. We have to remember that this is an HB4 bacteriology. The common explanation of the plague was connected to the idea of miasmata, miasma being foul air, rank air that float, that sort of hovered in, especially in cities. So in a medical culture in which air is associated with a medical danger, with health risks of such a scale, the insertion of sealants that were seen to be tighter, more sort of offering more protection from that influx of air became a new priority. And there is, medievalists have argued that generally privacy and even issues of comfort in this period were not so much understood in visual terms, the way for us, for instance, privacy and the sense of being protected at home is about, say, having curtains and being able to seclude ourselves in visual terms from the exterior. That in contrast, in the Middle Ages, it seems that olfactory protection, being shielded from dangerous air, became an increasingly important issue and ultimately defined what comfort and safety meant. And the hospitals, I think, take the lead in promoting this idea.
Which is fascinating, right, on many levels, both because of the kind of architectural side and because of what you've just told us, what insight it gives us into how people saw not just glass, but a lot of other things, right? It tells us what they think about privacy and infringement and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we're working on this question you raised of, like, how did we get to glass? But we're not quite there, because so far all we've got for glass is big cathedrals, churches, religious architecture that has sort of theological mm-hmm. reasons. Now we've got hospitals that, as we all know, kind of change forced by a pandemic is very real.
That's right.
And causes a lot of change. But what about kind of, we're still not there for kind of everyday people's homes. So when, how, and why did we transition not just into glass being the window sealant of preference, but even all the way to, like, as you said, we've forgotten these words. We think that using anything else is bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's where a third factor comes into play. As you said, we've talked about theology as a driving factor behind the general introduction of glass into especially religious architecture. Then I mentioned that the 14th century is important in that it creates forced opportunities because of the plague for the insertion of glass into particular types of, especially hospitals, of buildings associated with healthcare. And then in the 16th century, I think there's a particular climatic event, a macro event of sorts, that plays an important role, which is what we historians have come to call the Little Ice Age. Now, there's a lot of disagreement about the dating of the Little Ice Age. It is now established that there was one. Of course, it didn't start on one particular day, but it is thought, there's a consensus among historians that it begins sometime in the mid-16th century and that it lasts until the early 18th century. 1550 to 1720s are dates that are often cited in the literature. So a macro climatic phenomenon that came with prolonged cold periods, among other things, and that brought this question of insulation, which, as I said, was previously one primarily considered from an olfactory perspective, which brought this question of insulation to a new level and required people to, first of all, install other technologies in their homes that, for heating, for instance, there are historians, including in the British Isles, who have studied carefully the proliferation of chimneys in this period as an indicator of an increasing need for heat, domestic heat. But windows, glass windows, became part of this new regimen to protect oneself from these prolonged periods of cold. Now, that's not because glass is that the thermal efficiency of glass is all that impressive. It is not. But it is more. But it is still more efficient as a sealant than, say, those textile windows. And in that context, glass came to be endowed with a kind of class-based prestige that, again, in the British Isles, is particularly conspicuous. In those for the English British audience on this program might immediately think of the so-called prodigy houses that you have across England. They're sort of lantern houses, as they sometimes call, that sprout up in that particular moment in the 16th century. Places like Hardwick Hall, for instance, is particularly known, one of those prodigy houses, as they were called. For Hardwick Hall, they famously quipped, even at the time, Hardwick Hall, more glass than wall. There was that jingle, which encapsulated that those who could afford it would now make the display of domestic glass part of their, as Goffman would have it, as a presentation of self in everyday life. Glass became an object of conspicuous consumption in ways it had not, because it responded to certain pragmatic needs, but the ability to display it in abundance came to be tied up with questions of class. I call that chapter Glass and Class, not just because it rhymes nicely, but because I think that that's really where the power of that dynamic lies, in that people start to adopt this technology in light of climate change, as we would call it today, but at the same time, they endow it with a sense of inevitability that quickly spreads through society, so that by the end of the 18th century, glass has come to be seen as I said, inevitable. And this is very nicely reflected in English law in this time, which well into the 16th century, glass windows were windows in general, because of that mobility that I talked about earlier, the need to install them quickly and to remove them quickly, repair them quickly. Glass windows were seen as mobile elements. They could be inherited. The house and the windows could go to different heirs in a will in English law well into the 16th century. And from the 16th century onward, the legal thinking on this changes. And now the house and the windows are seen as inseparable in a legal transaction. The windows cannot be removed. And that is a reflection of the fact that now glass windows were seen to be essential in a ways that they hadn't been in a previous period.
I think this is perhaps one of the things I found most intriguing, maybe because it was the most familiar. It was, oh, wait, you're saying that the posh rich people decide on something, go and spend a lot of money and do it, and then over time that trickles down into everyone else thinking that must be how it works. That sounds like a lot of other material culture. I never would have put glass in that category. So,
yeah, nor would I. Again, a lot of this was new to me. I remember going to Hardwick Hall in England as a site that I wanted to see. I'd read so much about it. And as a historian, they're often, you often do research about places long before you go and see them. And therefore, you're not necessarily, there's a little, the effect of going can sometimes even be disappointing because the site doesn't live up. Hardwick Hall was the exact opposite. For me, it was an exceptional experience. I saw that place. I had read so much about it. And yet I thought, this is incredible. This kind of show-off use of glass is absolutely incredible. It points to a much larger cultural transformation. It cannot be understood without that context. This is not an eccentricity. This runs a lot deeper. This is about a hierarchy of material values that has changed profoundly as opposed to the previous period.
Absolutely. It's such a fabulous example. I want to stay on this idea of the cultural transformation because it's not just what you've talked about so far. There's another element that then comes up about the distinction between public and private buildings. Because again, going back to our assumption that we have now, that there's curtains, right? As you said, that in your own home, there's this idea of visual demarcation. but we seem to have a lot of public buildings that are really shiny, where there's a lot of glass involved. And that's a transformation too. So can you help us understand how and why this divide sprang up?
Yeah. So, I mean, it harks back to something you said earlier when you said that these tastes, the changing tastes trickle down, elites start to do something and then everyone else follows. On the whole, there is that dynamic, but it doesn't mean that reluctance didn't exist. Again, the elites can afford to do these things in ways that ordinary people cannot. There is an element of competition. It is conspicuous consumption. And still, there are older traditions that people had as far as, say, the personalization of their windows is concerned that weren't easily superseded. So there is, the introduction, the way in which glass, transparent glass especially, gradually prevails is a process that was met with resistance. People had to sort out issues that new issues that arose in that process. If the transparent glass window, large oversized window, is pushed as the new norm, how do you deal with questions of glare, for instance, which was not an issue in a period when, for centuries, when textile fabric sealants mediated or mitigated that issue. So people increasingly face that pressure to install glass windows, but it makes, at the same time, it creates a necessity to install curtains, as you said, you pointed to the curtains, to adjust to higher light levels, to adjust to the issues of visual privacy that arise. As I said, visual privacy was not a big concern to medieval householders, simply because it wasn't an issue that would arise given the technological circumstances and the fact that many windows were translucent rather than transparent. So people also have to adjust to new forms of visual privacy and in the infringement of visual privacy. So for that reason, there is that divide between, which you pointed out, between public versus private buildings, especially in the 18th century onwards, where you have elite projects, like think of the Chateau in Versailles with its famous Hall of Mirrors, which is a gigantic apparatus, if you will, to amplify the effect of daylight, both through oversized windows and then mirrors lining the walls that reflect that light and therefore create that sense of an abundance of light that, of course, served a political, that sent out a political message. But people in their everyday spaces can't do that, and they don't necessarily want to do this. And by the 19th century, that reluctance has grown into, in some circles, into a real resistance. In the 19th century, we see a darkening of interiors. We see a new taste for darkness in domestic spaces. The heavy furniture that we associate with the 19th century, the thick curtains, are a reflection of a certain unease that people have with a language of light that they feel is imposed on them and that serves often political and elite interests more than actually their private and domestic needs. So there is that dichotomy that by the 19th century is almost like the elephant in the room in architecture, because there's a marked divide between public architecture, the splendid glass houses, the crystal palaces that we see in the public sphere, and people's private desire to move to other lighting levels that are seen as less intrusive. And again, the question of visual privacy becomes much more to the fore.
Thank you for explaining that. I think there's probably a bunch of people sitting here imagining kind of, now I'm rethinking that place that I visited. Oh, that's what that was happening there, or something like that. So it's an interesting way to kind of understand things we might think we're familiar with, but with new information. And speaking of that, I'd love to stay on the topic of the public buildings for a moment, because they are often more visible and often quite extravagant, right? As you said, Crystal Palace, for example, in London, I mean, it's huge. That's a lot of glass. So this isn't a small thing that's being done just kind of as a one-off. And you link this to a wider context in the book, that this is not just possible because of money or because of improved technology, though that is part of it, but also about concepts of power, concepts of mastery more broadly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. I think with this architecture of public glass, power is always a theme that's present. It can take different manifestations. It can be about economic power. It can be about institutional power. I think the one of the best known examples here is Jeremy Bentham and his Panopticon, the kind of institutional surveillance that Bentham imagined, and that's been discussed by Michel Foucault and others. We know a lot about the history of that project, which actually never fully materialized. We know less about Bentham's deep dedication to glass as a material that would enable this surveillance. People have talked about the Panopticon often in terms of its ground plan and the way in which it makes it possible for the guards to observe the prisoners without the inmates knowing that. But glass was crucial in the actual material vision that Bentham had. And he's one of the people who explicitly links this choice of material to a form of social interaction that we now call transparency. There is a line in Bentham where he says, "My prison is," I'm quoting, "my prison is transparent, my management no less so." So here we have the origins of what I believe is that modern mantra, that or that kind of almost supernatural thinking of our time, that if you sheet buildings, if you envelope buildings in abundant glass, then somehow, miraculously, it will create a culture of social and institutional transparency, accountability. I think that is often wishful thinking, but here we have the origins of that idea, and we can see how it is tied to questions of power over others in a institution of confinement, which Panopticon was. There is another type of public glass buildings that comes into being proliferates in the 18th and especially 19th century. It's horticultural architecture. It's the glass houses. The Crystal Palace in London is, you could say, the most extravagant and most large-scale expression of this genre. It served, of course, many other purposes as well. But all the greenhouses and winter gardens that came to be seen as part of upper-class architecture and imperial architecture in the 19th century. Also, all these buildings also project a message of power. In this case, it's power over the natural environment. The ability to create a winter garden is in itself a paradoxical aspiration, the idea that you can have a garden in the winter, that you can basically create these islands of nature that are available year-round, that and islands of nature that can compensate for an accelerating environmental destruction, which is caused at that very moment in time by industrialization and increasing urban growth. So there is a paradoxical side to this development. Again, it is about projecting power over processes, natural processes that ultimately transcend our ability to control them as humans. We see this now with climate change as well. And there is also a power impulse as far as the display of exotic goods in these greenhouses, winter gardens is concerned. Having growing oranges in the British Isles in a glass house or any kind of other exotic fruit was more than anything else seen to be a message of colonial power that Europeans wielded across the globe. So instead of looking at horticultural architecture as just some form of benign domestic pastime, we really should look at this architecture as one that aspires to exhibit, like a museum, like a catalog, that tries to exhibit the European desire to control not just nature but also to control other parts of the world and to display plants, exotic plants, and other objects in these window cases turned buildings, in these showcases turned buildings.
Hmm. in that example, you referenced a few times kind of that we still have this, right? We still have greenhouses and try and control nature. We still envelop government buildings in glass as if that has some relation with what would happen inside of them. So as much as you were talking about kind of the more explicit forms of, you know, traditional forms of British imperialism, that answer, I think, gives us a great sense of kind of why are we like we are now, right? That's where it comes from, because that's very much what we still have. So if I ask you then to almost zoom out a bit further, now that we are sort of up to understanding where we're at now, you have this fascinating sentence in the book that the glass window, quote, reinforces the antagonistic relation between interior and exterior that runs deep in Western culture. Now that we've gone from the beginning up to essentially now, can you take us through this bigger picture idea?
Yeah. I mean, I think people might disagree with that argument. It's my reading of the material that there is that antagonistic relation between interior and exterior that has now come to be deeply embedded in Western culture. My thinking on this is based on some of these observations that I mentioned earlier, the way in which glass came to service and privilege our visual appetite, if you will, the idea that we can showcase things that windows should be become basically objects to frame the environment, the built environment, the natural environment in a way that privileges the visual sense. So it is it becomes a form of what Richard Sennett once called protected openness, right? We can indulge in our vision without actually having to face the other sensory dimensions that the natural environment comes with. It's in English, and I'm not a native speaker of English, as you can tell, so maybe I sometimes pay more attention to these linguistic, details, but in English you say you command a view, and I live in a city in Manhattan where people pay millions of dollars to command a view. The idea of standing behind a oversized glass window is one that people associate with power, the idea of economic power, of course, but also the idea, again, of being able to take in nature in this scopic way, in this optic way, without actually having to face all the other sensory challenges, too, that always come with a full experience of nature. And glass has minimized that exposure in often very subtle ways, but think of, as what I said earlier, the olfactory dimension. Our modern industrial tightly sealed windows, of course, completely insulate us from, say, urban smells, which is no longer something that we think of as a nuisance most of the time, any kind of smell that intrudes in our private space, and we expect the windows to keep that out. We now install what we call and what is sold as a soundproof glass. We expect glass to become a effective barrier against the exterior soundscape. And in that process, again, this is our understanding of comfort. And I'm not saying that my expectations are other than that of that they differ from other people's. Of course, it's hard to extract yourself from these cultural conventions. Especially when they've become collective. But it's worth reflecting, I believe, on this point, on how we have reduced windows to a visual frame, basically. And that is also reflected in so much of modern and contemporary architecture, where the uniformity of window design, the very fact that we have resigned, if you will, to the idea that the window must always be rectangular, which in itself is reminiscent of a picture frame, that uniformity is I believe to some extent a reflection of an atrophy of the window as a space that could serve much more as an interface between exterior and exterior than as a protective barrier. There are other architectural traditions where you can still observe that a function of the window serving as a interface rather than as a protective barrier. I talk in the book, in the epilogue especially, about traditional Japanese architecture, which has always fascinated me as a counterexample. Granted, it's Japan has also moved to the Western understanding of the window. Anyone who's been to Tokyo can confirm that. But the old idea of windows as in traditional Japanese architecture of elements that slide rather than open, as the delicate interplay between light and shadow, the idea that the window is actually, or the window's frame is something that can be can open in different grades and different degrees, rather than being than functioning in this binary understanding of open versus shut and nothing in between. These are things that fascinate me because they point to a wealth of other ways of thinking about the more fluid ways of thinking about that relation between interior and exterior.
Absolutely. And even just in the examples you've mentioned from earlier time periods, there's other ways of thinking visible there as well. I'd love to ask you about something that we both have referenced, but kind of not fully poked at yet. And in the spirit of reflecting on things that are so culturally dominant, I'd love to ask you about how we might critically consider ideas that, as we've talked about, government, public offices can be made transparent by being sheathed in glass, by using words that are related to glass. Can you talk us through maybe the extent to which we should be skeptical of this idea?
Yes. I mean, first of all, that's, I think, where the study of the past can be helpful, because as the book is sort of winding up and gets into the 20th century, I'm trying to talk about the raw ambiguities, the contradiction inherent to this imagery of transparency. And I actually show how, for instance, fascist regimes adopted this language of transparency for their co-opted it for their own purposes. The glass architecture in the early 20th century was associated with modernism. It was associated with the international style and what Mies van der Rohe and others would consider to be a kind of honest architecture. So our modern understanding of transparency as being a socially good thing has its root in that discourse. But when you get to the interwar period, and especially to the 1930s, you can see that both, say, Italian fascism and also the Third Reich adopted some of these ideas for their own purposes. Mussolini was a great proponent of glass architecture. Hitler had pronounced taste for oversized windows. I talk about that too. There's a whole propaganda apparatus in the Third Reich that promotes the idea of a race, Germans as a race of light, and therefore the idea that German architecture should also involve these amply fenestrated walls. So when you start to read these things, you realize that transparency per se is not a good thing. It is something that was used and co-opted by in both sort of democratic discourses, but also in authoritarian discourses. The logic of accountability and the logic of surveillance can easily become entangled. And the other thing to consider is so once we understand that there's somewhat of a fiction involved here in the idea that glass will automatically create good environments and socially beneficial environments, the other thing to consider is the enormous ecological price tag that this architecture has, the price that we pay for these fantasies of power and accountability that our glass buildings are. In an age of climate change, we know that there are glass buildings are among the greatest contributors in cities to global warming because of their a carbon footprint, the way in which they often glass towers, say here in New York City, there was an attempt to ban them. In fact, under the previous mayor, an attempt to ban glass buildings from the city, the construction of new glass buildings altogether. That never went anywhere. There are powerful interests that prevented that from happening. But everyone who knows something about these things knows that glass buildings are ecologically often not efficient. They require permanent air conditioning during heat periods because, of course, the greenhouse effect, we talked about the greenhouses in the winter gardens, the greenhouse effect applies to these buildings as well. And in wintertime, you have the opposite effect. You have these buildings often need dehumidification to become inhabitable or pleasant. So there is that issue, and we have to reflect on that, because I think what we've come to expect from certain types of political and corporate architecture is a promise of transparency and accountability that actually is a mismatch as to what the institutions can deliver, and the price tag that it comes with is more than counterproductive for the kind of architecture that we would actually need.
So that's obviously, I think, something we all have a lot of opportunity to rethink, right? Listening to this and walking into kind of any major city, you'd have a lot to kind of go, hang on a second, what, you know, look at that big skyscraper, what is that trying to say, and why might I want to be critical about it? But throughout this interview, we've highlighted a number of things that people might want to rethink about architectural glass based on this book. I know kind of what has been running through my mind having read it, but given that you are so much in the depths and the expertise of this, what would you like listeners and readers to consider next time they look at architectural glass?
Well, one lesson that I would be happy if people take away from this is, first of all, to, you know, that there are very few things in our built environment that are God-given, that exist for natural reasons. These are cultural conventions that have emerged over very long periods of time. And I think it is instructive as an object lesson, if you will, to reflect on the way in which societies have come to embrace certain choices, certain materials. And that is almost from a philosophical point of view, I think that's always a good process of reflection. The other thing I'd like to take people away is more concrete. Can we still afford this kind of architecture ecologically, given the moment we are in, the climate change we're seeing? What would a sustainable architecture, one that cares less about symbolism and symbolic messaging, but more about sustainability and responsibility, stewardship, what would an architecture like this look like? There are architectural firms that have been building more along these lines, and that is heartening. As I said, there have been political efforts to contain some of the excesses, but some of these efforts, you know, reached an impasse. As I said, the ban on glass and architecture here in New York never came into existence and came stalled for because there are vested interests in play as well. And the third factor is again sort of a more macro point, the global dimension of this, the way in which we universalize what is a very European tradition, historically speaking, of building. It is very badly suited to parts of the world where extended heat periods are, for instance, part of the annual seasonal cycle. There are, I know, people in the field who have spoken about glass architecture as a form of environmental colonialism, I'm quoting. And I think that's another point to reflect on, the way in which a certain idiom of Western architecture has come to be universalized and is postulated as being universally desirable, when in fact it has superseded fascinating traditional idioms of architecture, different understandings also of light, of privacy, of sustainability, and whether we can actually, by taking a step back, whether we can not only make more space for these older traditions to to be recovered, but also and to learn from other understandings of what is ultimately the relation between humans and the natural environment. That relationship maybe doesn't need to be as antagonistic, coming back to your earlier question, doesn't need to be as antagonistic as our architecture often, I think, compels us to think it must be. There may be ways to think about the relation between interior and exterior in a way that is a lot more fluid and less categorical than we are used to. There would be a learning process. And if the book can inspire people to learn about that process, to learn about that history, I feel I've accomplished more than I could have wished at the outset.
Well, the book is available. People can go read it and start going through that process, which leaves me really only with my final question. I almost hesitate to ask because of how much of an accomplishment really this book is, but it is done. Is there anything you might be working on now or next, whether or not it's a book, whether or not it's on transparency, that you'd like to preview for us?
Thank you. Well, that's kind of you, Miranda. No, nothing on transparency anymore, nothing on glass and windows. I've worked on that subject for so many years. I feel I've said whatever I had to say in this book, and I'm happy to move on and to leave the reader maybe with some of those questions. I'm not saying I have definitive answers, but I have some questions, and others can bring their own expertise to that. I will go into a period of recovery. First of all, the book was very demanding to put together. I've never done anything on that scale. Also with images, the book has 130 images in color. I must say that as a historian, nothing had prepared me. As someone who's working more textual, you know, methods, usually nothing had prepared me for that logistical challenge. So all I can say, after I reemerge from a period of recovery, I have ideas for a new project, which would be on the history of mobility, very different subject, especially vehicular mobility. I would be more in my home turf of early modernity, the period between the 15th and 18th century, the way in which mobility became a part of people's everyday life, especially in cities. So you can see me still wearing the hat of the urban historian here. But again, I would try to take it all the way to the modern period, certainly in some extended epilogue, because I think that's another issue that is, present and pressing, I think, for many people today, mobility and its excesses. And I'm interested in the historical origins of that phenomenon.
Well, that sounds fascinating. So best of luck with that. But I'm glad you're taking a break, much deserved. And of course, for listeners who are intrigued, the book we've been discussing is titled Transparency, The Material History of an Idea, published by Yale University Press in 2023. Daniel, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Of course. Thank you, Miranda, for this wonderful interview.